offering my most humble pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. I pray to Bhagwan that he gives us all the understanding, that he alone is the one who speaks, he alone is the one who listens. Elders, sisters and brothers, Sai Ram to all of you. Once a couple wanted to go out for a movie, and this was the most popular movie in town. It was a murder thriller, right? Everybody was interested in seeing it. It had an extremely interesting plot, which culminated in a thrilling climax. And it was all about a murder and about how they go about finding who the murderer is. So this couple sets out, they take a cab, and they get off near the theater. And as it happens many times, they have a small fight with a cab driver. The cab driver says that you owe me 250 bucks. The man says, no, I'm not going to give you a penny more than 200. So there's a fight which goes on. You know, the cab driver says, no, you owe me so much more. And the man says, definitely I'm not giving you any bit more. So finally what the man does, he puts 200 rupees in the hand of that cab driver and starts walking away. He says, you're not getting any more from me. So this cab driver, he peers out of his window, he looks at the theater, he knows which movie they're going to, and he asks, you will not give me 250 bucks? All right, go for the movie. The butler is the murderer. He says, all right, go ahead for the movie. The butler is the murderer. So in one line, he finishes off what would have been 3 hours of fun. I was listening to a talk, very interesting one, by one of the foremost script writers of Hollywood. Right? He is supposed to have given some of the most famous animation movies. And he's claimed to be one of the best scriptwriters of Hollywood. Very, very successful man. So he was giving a talk on storytelling. How do you tell a story? And he was revealing some facts which, while watching a movie, we might not really know sometimes. He said that the two most important aspects of storytelling is anticipation and suspense. How often in the story or in the plot of the story are you able to inspire the feeling of anticipation? And how beautifully it culminates in a wonderful suspense. You know, that is what really makes a story gripping. So he said, whatever story they do, and he started playing a few of the clips which he has made, and he said, see, this is how we brought in the idea of anticipation. While watching the movie, we might not have realized it, but actually at every time, you're wondering what is going to happen next. If that is what makes a story interesting, if that is what makes a story valuable and gripping, how come there are some stories which we keep listening over and over again, but we are still not tired of it? How come there are some stories we have heard from so many people, we have read so many versions of, and we know every point of that plot? We know what is going to happen, what each character is going to say, but still we enjoy those stories. And I presume most of you here would have read the topic of today's talk, and in spite of knowing that it is on the Ramayana, which you have grown up with, which you have read so many times, you still chose to come and sit here. Doesn't that mean that there are some stories which you don't mind hearing again and again? Why is that so? Let's say you are an art enthusiast, you're crazy after paintings. You go out into an art gallery and you buy a painting for, let's say, 50,000 rupees. A very expensive, very, very beautifully made painting. You bring it home, you put it on the wall, you look at it for 1 day, you look at it for 2 days, you look at it for 3 or 4 days, and you're so enamored by the art. But after that it's just on the wall. You're happy it's there. You're happy it is there to ornate your wall, but you don't keep looking at it again and again. Let's say you buy a mirror for 1,000 rupees. You put it on the wall of your bedroom. Even though it's much cheaper than that painting, won't we go and look at that piece of framed glass every single day, multiple times on the same day, and do that for years to come? How's that? It is because a painting shows what it has. A mirror shows what you are. And what you are keeps changing every day. Your hair is graying, your hairline is receding, you wear different clothes every day, your features are changing. A mirror shows you what you are at that point of time. Some stories tell you a story, some stories show you who you are. And that is why those stories can be seen any number of times, heard any number of times, because the story grows with you. As you grow, the story's profundity grows with you. And the Ramayana is one such phenomenal story. So keep this point in mind, that the Ramayana is meant to show you to you. The Ramayana is not here to tell you a story. The Ramayana is here to tell you your story, right? But we'll keep that aside, we'll come to that later. You know, it's an interesting story nevertheless. One of the foreign commentators once made a comment. He said, I'm not sure if the Ramayana is a historical work or a mythological work. If it is historical, then we're very happy that we know of a past so glorious. If it is mythological, he says that I am in awe of the author, because in the span of the story, he has described the geography of this subcontinent so perfectly that even today, we know that it is the same. And that is why time and again, from different cultures, different authors wanted to take the Ramayana and make it their own. They wanted to give their version. And it is of interest to go and see all these versions, because each one of them gives a different perspective, right? But broadly, we can categorize the type of Ramayanas into three. I will talk of the first two first. The first, of course, is the original, right? Written by Valmiki himself. The second is those written by Tulsidas. You have the Kamba Ramayana. You have Ramayanas in different regions, rewritten by different authors. What was the perspective with which Valmiki wrote the Ramayana? The first and foremost Ramayana. The story goes that Valmiki has come out of his penance. The dacoit Ratnakara has transformed himself into a sage through his penance. He's become Valmiki. And one day he is obsessed with a thought. He's wondering, he's thinking to himself, can there be perfection in mankind? Is there any one individual who embodies perfection? Is there a perfect man on earth right now, or has he ever lived? This is the thought which is, you know, he's obsessed with. It's going on and on again in his mind. And one day he goes out for his morning ablutions and he sees this beautiful sight of two crowncha birds sitting on a branch, lost in the ecstasy of love. He's lost in the beauty of nature. And just then a hunter shoots down one of those birds. And he's so pained by it, you know, he's so moved with grief. So on the spot, he curses the hunter. But the beauty is, he curses the hunter through a poem. He doesn't just make a statement, make a phrase. He makes a poem. And he's surprised. Why is he surprised? Because till then, in history, there was nothing like a poem. Till then in history, there was only the Shrutis. You know, the Vedas are Shrutis, that which was heard. Never once somebody had written in a meter something like a poem. So Valmiki himself is surprised by what has happened. On one hand, he's pained that he's lost his balance and he's cursed the hunter. On the other, he's surprised that this poem has come spontaneously out of him. And then Brahma appears before him. And he asks the two questions which are troubling him. He says, what is this phenomenon? A poem has come out from me. And the other thing is there a man who is so perfect that all of humanity can look up to? And then Brahma says, Lord Brahma says, yes, there is. And his name is Lord Rama. He is the Lord incarnated as a human being, and he will lead a life of a perfect human being. And this verse which has come out of you is the first poem in history, and that is why we refer to Valmiki as Adi Kavi, the first poet. So then in the same meter he goes on to compose the entire Ramayana. He's given a blessing that the whole of Ramayana will play like a movie in front of his eyes, even as he makes it into poetry. And that's how the epic Ramayana comes to be. But the hint here is, throughout the story of Ramayana, Valmiki is looking at Rama as a perfect man. Right? He's not looking at Rama as God. He's not looking at Rama as an avatar. Though there are references here and there, but the tone of the narrative is, here is a perfect man, my contemporary. So the Valmiki Ramayana is a man looking at a man. Then you have the other Ramayanas. The other foremost is Tulsi Ramayana. Interestingly, Tulsidas also is given the same blessing. Even as he starts writing the Ramayana plays in front of his eyes, similar to what happens with Valmiki. But this time, Tulsidas is writing about his Lord. He's writing about Lord Rama. So the tone is always devotional. So you can understand that eulogizing is part of that story, right? Hyperboles are given. There are always exaggerations. But there is a tone of devotion in that narrative. There is that very interesting episode they usually say about the Tulsi Ramayana, where he's writing the part where Mother Sita is in the Ashokavana, Ashokavatika, the garden. She's captured there by Ravana, and he's going into the description of how beautiful that garden is. So he starts describing the flowers, the bowers, and this and that, and the ponds. And then he says, around where Sita was sitting, there were white flowers. And it is a belief that wherever Rama's story is said, wherever Rama's name is taken, who is present? Lord Hanuman is present, right? So throughout that period where Tulsidas writes the Ramayana, Hanuman is sitting beside him. And when this point comes, and he says that there were white flowers around Sita, he protests. He says, no, there were no white flowers there. And Sant Tulsidas says that, no, Hanuman, you've got it wrong. There were white flowers. I can see it. So Hanuman protests. He says, no, I was the one who went to Ashokvatika, and I was the one who destroyed it. I know that there were no white flowers there. There were red flowers. He says there were red flowers. And then Tulsidas explains, Hanuman, you were so angry when you went to Ashokvatika that your eyes were red with temper. And all that you saw as white was, all that you saw as red was actually white. So here was Tulsidas, who came eons later, but was able to describe Ramayana more accurately even than the characters of Ramayana. So Tulsi Ramayana also has its own value, right? Kamba Ramayana is one such. He again is a devotee who describes his Lord. He's a poet. Basically, Kamban is a poet. So his work is overflowing with poetry and similes and metaphors. But two categories. One, the original, Valmiki writes as a man looking at a man. The other is that of Tulsidas, Kamba Ramayana, and all the other Ramayanas that followed, where man looks at God. But there is a third category, right? Let's say we see a complex movie, a very, very profound movie. We take a lot of meanings out of it. There are layers and layers of understandings that come out of it. But at the end of the day, we say, let's go and read about the movie. What was the idea with which the movie was made? Right? We want to know the director's perspective, isn't it? Because that's the right perspective. when the movie maker made the movie, with what idea did he make it? You can take a million meanings out of it, but what was the meaning that was meant to be? And if you want to know that meaning, that is where what Swami is written as Ramakatha Rasavahini comes in. Because that is not how man looks at man, that is not how man looks at God, but that is how God looks at God. That is how avatar looks at avatarhood. And that is why what Swami has given in the form of the Ramakatha Rasavahini, in the form of the many discourses, because Ramakatha Rasavahini itself is not complete. There was a 1996 summer course series where entirely Swami spoke about the Ramayana, and many, many other discourses where Swami completes the story of Ramayana so beautifully. There are many places where Swami's Ramayana and Swami's narrative is different from Valmiki's himself. Let's just take one part where there is a stark difference, where there's a resounding difference. We all know the story of the Payasam, how Rama, Lakshmana, Bharata and Shatrughna are born after the celestial Payasam is handed over. But the first queen, Kaushalya, gets one son. The third queen, Kaikeyi, gets one son. But the second queen, Sumitra, gets two sons, right? She gets Lakshmana and Shatrughna. Valmiki has an interesting way of putting it. He says Dashrata comes, he gives one portion to Kaushalya, gives one portion to Sumitra, gives one portion to Kaikeyi, and then there is a little left over. And now Dashrata is thinking, see, Kaushalya is the first queen, senior queen. So her son, the prince born out of her, will definitely be respected. Kaikeyi has got the boon, her father has got a boon that whoever is born from Kaikeyi will rule the kingdom. So Kaikeyi too will have the honor of being the Rajmata. But Dashrata thinks, what about Sumitra? No, isn't she the unfortunate one? So Valmiki says, out of compassion, he goes back and gives some more payasam to Sumitra. Well, interesting nevertheless, but is it complete? But Swami's narrative is very different, and it actually explains one aspect of the Ramayana which is left unexplained otherwise. Swami says that the payasam was equally distributed between the three, because Swami emphasizes equally. Because who does the distribution? Sage Vasishtha himself. So he's not one who's going to mess up the measurements, right? So he gives equal measures to the three queens. And what Valmiki said was Dasharatha's thinking, Swami says, was actually Sumitra's thinking. Sumitra is thinking all the while, what will happen to my son? He will not rule the kingdom. What will happen to my son? And thinking thus, she takes her share, and Swami says very graphically that she has her bath, she goes to the terrace, and Swami would beautifully say, those days no hair dryers, so they have to take that sambrani, and she goes to the terrace, drying her hair, ruminating over what would be her future and the future of her son. And she's lost in thought when an eagle comes and takes away the golden cup of payasam. So in a moment of carelessness, she loses that precious payasam and she doesn't know what to do. She goes and tells this to Vasishtha or her husband, what would be her plight? So she runs to her co-sisters. She runs to Kaushalya, she runs to Kaikeyi and cries to them, this is what has happened. So what do? They take another empty gold vessel. Kaushalya pours one half of hers. Kaikeyi pours one half of hers. And now Sumitra too has payasam to drink. Why is this episode so significant? Because Swami says in his Ramakatha that after the four children are born, Rama is always happy and fine. Bharata is always happy and fine. But these two twins, Lakshmana and Shatrughna, are always crying. And so Sumitra runs to sage Vasishtha and says, what do I do? Why are they always crying? So Vasishtha goes into meditation and he realizes what has conspired between the three queens. And he tells, you take Lakshmana and put him in the same cradle as Rama, take Shatrughna and put him in the same cradle as Bharata. Because Swami says that Lakshmana has come from that part which was meant to be Rama, and Shatrughna has come from that part which was meant to be Bharata. And that is why this natural affiliation between the brothers. But what makes it more profound is, Swami tells in his discourses, what do these four brothers represent? Rama, Lakshmana, Bharata and Shatrughna. Swami says that they represent Satya, Dharma, Prema and Shanti. Right? And Swami says, Rama is of course Satya. Why? Because Rama is Atma. As we go on, we'll see why this is so significant. Rama represents the Atma, and Atma represents Brahman, Brahma Satyam. So Rama stands for Satya. And Swami says that Bharata says, whatever happens, Satya should rule. Whatever happens, truth should be the emperor. So he is Dharma. That which says that what is righteous, what is right should always happen, even at the cost of my well-being. So he represents Dharma. Lakshmana, of course, represents Prema because he's not himself. He's given himself completely. So he represents Prema, and Shatrughna, only one thing is left over, so he's Shanti. But of course, it's not so casual because now see the difference. Where did Lakshmana come from? He came from Rama's portion. So what is closest to Atma? It is love. And where did Shanti come from? Shanti came from Bharata, who represents Dharma. So true peace is born out of a dharmic life. Na shreyo niyamam vina, right? That's what the Vedas say. Without discipline in life, there cannot be well-being. And without well-being, where is peace? So that which comes out of that portion which represents Dharma is Shanti. So that is why these small twists that Swami gives, rather not twists, the small leftover portions which Swami fills becomes so important, isn't it? But what happens to the third part of the payasam? That's the mystery, right? Because it's no mystery to us, we all know what happens. Swami says that eagle takes that vessel and flies across and goes to Queen Anjani Devi. And who's Queen Anjani Devi? She is the one who in future gives birth to Lord Hanuman. So Hanuman too is actually an aspect of these four brothers. But what does Hanuman represent if these are Satya, Dharma, Shanti, Prema? Not Ahimsa. We'll come to that because that again is very beautiful. Whenever Swami talks of the Ramayana, now Swami says that the Ramayana is eternal. There is a shloka which even Valmiki says, I think, where he says that as long as the mountains and the rivers are there, Ramayana will ever be there. Swami says, why does he say that? Swami says that the mountains represent men, the rivers represent women. And as long as men and women are alive, the story of Ramayana will be alive because, Swami says, it is the story of each individual. In the Ramayana, there is a part where Hanuman is once asked a question. No, he's asked, who is Rama to you? What is your relationship between you and Rama? I'm not sure, some versions say that Rama himself asks Hanuman this question. Some say that Mother Sita asks Hanuman this question. But nevertheless, the answer is the same. So what does Hanuman say? He says, when I think that I am this body, I am a servant of Lord Rama, Dasoham. Right? When I think I am this body, I am a servant of my Lord. When I think I am a Jivatma, when I think I am a Jivi, an individual entity, he says, I am a spark of that flame that Lord Rama is. I am an Amsha. Right? He says, if I think I am the body, I am a Dasa, a servant. When I think I am a Jivatma, a Jivi, I am an Amsha. a spark. But when I believe I am the Atman, I am Lord Rama. Well, we praise Hanuman for this wonderful answer that he has given and we glorify him, but we forget that what Hanuman is putting forth is actually a hint. And what is that hint? He says, each one of us also have these three complexes in us. So when we look at Ramayana, we have to look at it from these three perspectives. We all look at Rama as the Lord. We celebrate the Ramanavami and all other festivals. We are ready to fight for his temple. So that aspect is taken care of. We all worship Lord Rama as the Lord. When he says, I am an Amsha, Swami says that it's not enough if you just read the Ramayana, you have to imbibe the values in it. All right, it's a guidebook. The Ramayana becomes a moral guidebook. But the third aspect is, Swami says, you are Rama. Why? Only Rama among all avatars is referred to as Atma Rama. Right? We don't say Atma Krishna. We don't say Atma Vamana. We don't say Atma, definitely not Atma Narsimurti. But why Atma Rama? Because Swami says Lord Rama represents the Atma, and the entire Ramayana is actually the journey of the Atma till he reaches its ultimate goal. And each one of the characters in the Ramayana are within us, are within human experience, are within human emotions. And when you look at Ramayana like this, every scene of the Ramayana will come with a different meaning, will become like a fuel to a sadhaka. There is this aspect where Rama is born and, you know, he's finished his education under the tutelage of Vasishtha. So he goes out into the kingdom just on a fun tour. They go around, and during that tour, Rama and Lakshmana get into spiritual discussions with lot of jnanis and sages and saints. And for the first time, this character Rama is coming face to face with the concept of Advaita. And he's totally unsettled. Because till then he's brought up as a prince. Till then he's been told that you have to one day come and rule the kingdom. This is your father, you have to respect him. These are your mothers, you have to respect them. These are your brothers, you have to take care of them. But suddenly he's told that everybody is one. Nobody is greater than the other. So he is unsettled. He doesn't know what to do. When first Advaita is given, it unsettles you. So the first one who steps forward and counsels Rama and brings him back to balance, or at least tries to, is Vasishtha. And that's how we have the Yoga Vasishtha. Right, it's the book of which comes from this part of the Ramayana where Vasishtha comes and tries to counsel Rama. So first, when a sadhaka takes to this journey to find out his reality, when the reality comes to him in raw, like, you know, Swami says, you are God, you know, it's given to you as raw data, it kind of makes you lose your balance. So the first guru who says that, yes, this is true, but you need to come to a balance and you need to synthesize this with what you undergo in everyday life. So that guru is Vasishtha. But then another guru steps in. Who is that? Vishwamitra comes, right? Vishwamitra says, keep your confusion with yourself. I have nothing to do with it. Keep your questions to yourself. Come and do my work. He says, come and do my work. And Swami would describe in his Ramayana that throughout the journey which Lakshmana and Rama go out with Vishwamitra, Vishwamitra is constantly counseling these two boys. Why is that important? Because Vishwamitra has a different past from Vasishtha, right? Vishwamitra is the great King Kaushika who has become a sage. So in a sense, Vishwamitra represents a character who has synthesized success in worldly life and in the spiritual life. So he forms the bridge between this and that. And it is that knowledge which he gives to Rama. A little bit of balance comes. But what is the most important role that Vishwamitra plays there? And Swami says in Ramakatha that that is the last important role that Vishwamitra plays. He takes Rama and Lakshmana to Mother Sita. And after the marriage, Vishwamitra actually vanishes from the scene. He goes away never to return, because that's the last important task he plays. So why is Sita so important? Many times we've heard Swami saying this. Swami would say, I am God, so are you. I know it, but you do not. So what do we gather from this statement? Isn't it that it is not important to just being God? It is important to know that you are God, right? Rama represents the Atma, he is divine himself, but left alone he is Jivatma. And what Mother Sita represents is, Swami says, she is Brahma Chaitanya. She is the Brahma Gnan. That knowledge that Atma is divine, that is represented by Sita. So what Vishwamitra does is, he takes Rama and takes, this is Brahma Gnan. It is only when you have this, you are God. Because you are God, but you don't know it. And this is that knowledge, I am getting you to that. So that is the role Vishwamitra plays as a guru. Then who is Janaka? We all know Janaka is a great Raja Yogi, right? He is a king nevertheless, but he is one who has conquered the inner realms. And Swami would say that there are two aspects of realization. There are two ways in realization can be had. One is called Jivan Mukti, right? What we often say, where during your living time, you realize that everything is one. But one stage higher than that, Swami says, is Videha Mukti. Mukti which is coupled with complete loss of body consciousness. That is higher than Jivan Mukti. And Swami says that one who has achieved this is Janaka. That is why he is called Videha. The other name of Janaka is Videha. And who does Janaka give? He gives Vaidehi. So this king Janaka, what does he give Rama? He gives Rama the knowledge that you are God. And when does he give it? After the Shiva Dhanush is broken. And that bow represents ego. And now look at it, what does Janaka give? Janaka gives Brahma Gnan. And now when we look back at the quote which Swami says, we have heard it many times from Swami. Swami says, have the head of Shankara, the heart of Buddha, and the hands of Janaka. What did the hands of Janaka give? The hands of Janaka gave Brahma Gnan. True charity is when you are able to give the knowledge of the self. Have the hands of Janaka, Swami said. And that Janaka gives Sita, and Swami would often say that that marriage between Rama and Sita is actually the moment of Jivan Mukti. It's a moment of Jivan Mukti. And of course, no description or narration of this Rama Sita Kalyanam is complete without that one beautiful episode that Swami would often narrate, right? When Rama and Sita are supposed to garland each other, Swami would say Sita was very short, Rama was extremely tall. So she was not able to reach Rama's neck. And every time Swami would tell this, Swami would laugh, the audience would laugh, we all would laugh. But something more funny, I remember in one of our campuses, they had this quiz program. Let's get the right version of the story first. So apparently Swami says that Sita is not able to garland Rama. So Rama looks at Lakshmana. Lakshmana comes and falls at Rama's feet, and Rama bends down to pick up Lakshmana, and when he bends, Sita garlands, right? So this is the actual story. Once during a quiz competition, they asked, what happens during the Rama Sita Kalyanam when Sita is not able to garland Rama? So one of the students, with all excitement, they put up their hand and he says, I know. So the quiz master says, yes, what is the answer? And this student says, this is what happened. Sita could not garland. Lakshmana comes and falls at Rama's feet. Sita climbs over Lakshmana and puts the garland. Thankfully, that's not what happened. But even in this funny episode, there is a beautiful message. Why is it? Because what does Lakshmana represent? Swami says Lakshmana represents the mind. The mind with all its abilities. The mind with its ability to discriminate, with its ability to remember, with its ability to think, everything. Lakshmana represents that mind. And isn't it beautiful now when the mind bows down to the Atma, it is only then this jnana can understand even the Atma. Because what Swami says, Brahmagnana is also not the complete knowledge of the Atma. Because the knowledge of the Atma is so profound, it cannot be held in a human mind. So it is only when the divinity within condescends to be understood, even the mind can understand. And what is the first step to that? The mind has to bow down in front of the Atma, in front of the Lord. So, well, this is the story. It goes on like this. Each of the characters have different representations. Let's maybe jump the gun, because where is the story without the villain, right? Ravana has to come in. And what does this Ravana represent? He's a brilliant character. He's a brilliant character. Grossly, he represents desire, right? He represents passion. He represents rajas. For all practical means, he represents desire. So Swami goes on to say that even after you have gained the knowledge can be taken away from you if this flame of desire has not been put down. You know, in the Ramayana, the character of Ravana is glorified to no end. He's supposed to be a phenomenal warrior. He is one who has conquered many kings, many earthly denizens, and then he goes on to defeat even the gods, right? He defeats Indra, he defeats all the other gods. And there is this beautiful episode which is so filled with profundity, where finally Ravana goes and challenges Lord Yama. He goes and challenges Lord Yama. Imagine, he is the Lord of Death. Here is Ravana who has the audacity to go and challenge Death. And he says, come, I've defeated everybody, come, fight with me, if you can defeat me. And Lord Yama is having a hearty laugh. What is on to your head? I am the Lord of Death. I just have to throw the noose around you and you will be finished. And he says, all right, prepare to die. And he's about to cast the noose, when the story goes that Brahma appears there and he stops Yama. Of course, the dramatic part of the story is Brahma says, stop, you cannot do it, because according to the plot, Rama has to come and defeat Ravana. If you kill it, you know, you're upsetting the whole plot. But what is the essence of this story? What is Brahma, the creator of this entire drama, what is the message he's saying? He's saying Ravana represents desire. Never death can put an end to desire. Never death can actually end desire, because desire will keep coming again and again and again, as many births as you take. What can put an end to desire? Only the individual Jivatma who is going in search of the Brahmagnan, only he has the power to put off who? Desire. And that is why Brahma appears there and says, try as much as you may, you cannot put an end to Ravana, because Ravana represents desire. Only Atma can put an end to desire. Let Rama do his task. And before Ravana is killed, who has to be killed? Indrajit has to be killed. He's like the strongest fort before him. And what is the boon that Indrajit has? He says, you know, very brilliant guy. He gets this boon from, I don't know, Brahma or Shiva, that only a man who is married and after marriage lives a life of celibacy for 14 years can come and kill me. Because he knows that there is no man who might live a life like that. Only a man who's lived a life of celibacy for 14 years after marriage can come and kill me. And isn't that why Lakshmana is prepared? But the other thing is, in another place, Swami tells a beautiful explanation of why Lakshmana went without food and sleep. You know, that is one of the descriptions of Lakshmana, that he never slept for 14 years. How can anybody be without sleep for 14 years? How can anybody live without food for 14 years? In one of the explanations Swami gives, Swami says, Lakshmana ate only when he had to eat. Lakshmana slept only when he had to sleep. Which means, never once this character Lakshmana indulged in sleep. Sleep was only given when it was most necessary. And in this attempt to reach Brahmagnan, what has the mind got to do? The mind has to put this restriction on itself, that I will not indulge. I will eat only as much as I need. I will sleep only as much as I need. I will take care of this body only as much as it is required. That is the discipline the mind has to have, and it is that mind which aids this Jivatma to achieve the goal of bringing back that Brahmagnan which has been lost. But why is this played if Sita represents Brahmagnan or Brahma Chaitanya or whatever it may be? Why is she first given in marriage and then taken away? In a discourse, Swami very beautifully explains why this drama is played, and this is explained because this is a lesson for each one of us. He says, because of all the good we have done, because of all the study that you have done, this knowledge of the self can be given to you. Even Jivan Mukti can be attained. But at some point, this Mukti, this Jnana should become Anubhava Jnana. It should become knowledge which is gained from practice. And this entire episode which happens, which Rama goes out in search, meets with Sugriva, meets with Hanuman, all that is actually adding to that Anubhava Jnana. Now he has earned Sita back. He's truly earned Sita back. And whom does he meet? Who else does he take the help of? Hanuman is the first character he meets. And who is Hanuman? Who is Hanuman? He is the one who is born from the same Paisam. What does Hanuman represent? Swami says Hanuman represents fearlessness. Hanuman represents dhairyam, valor. And why is it important to remember that he has come from the same Paisam? One of the qualities of Atma is fearlessness. How many times Swami has told this? Fearlessness is actually a sign of one who has attained oneness with himself. And that is why Hanuman has come from that same vessel from which Rama, Lakshmana, Bharata and Shatrughna have come. Because fearlessness comes from the same aspect which gives out Jivatma. What does Sugriva represent? Swami says Sugriva represents discrimination. And discrimination has to beat whom? He has to beat Vali. And Vali represents despair. Vali represents the dark emotions of despair and despondency. And it is only when this discrimination wins over that despair and despondency. And whom does Sugriva use? Sugriva uses the army of monkeys. And what are these army of monkeys? Aren't they our thoughts? Right? Why does Swami say mind is like a mad monkey? Each thought is like a monkey. It jumps, goes on and on and on and on. But even a band of monkeys, when being led by Sugriva, who represents discrimination, even monkey mind can be useful for attaining the ultimate goal. And that is what Sugriva represents, and that is what the army of monkeys represent. And this is how Sita is got back. Having said all that, let's take Ramayana as a story. Many times we wonder, if Rama was meant to be an ideal man, why are there so many controversies in the story? You know, there are so many twists and turns in the plot which can be questioned even by you and me, average mortals, right? I mean, we won't follow anything else of Rama, but we'll question this. We'll ask, why this? Why did you do this? one of the students asked Swami, he said, Swami, in the Ramayana you have said that, you know, Rama was so sworn to Pitru Vaka Paripalana that whatever happens, I will hold on to this word my father has given. Should we also listen to our father like that? I don't know with what running in his mind this boy asked that question. But nevertheless, he said, Swami, should we also follow our fathers like this, that whatever the father says, we have to follow? And Swami very beautifully smiled and said, if you have a father like Dasharatha, then you have to follow. Because Dasharatha was not an ordinary man. He was a great king. He was a man of dharma himself. So he said, if you have a father like Dasharatha, then you have to follow whatever he says. But many times we want to take literal meanings out of the story, right? Why did he do this? Why did he shoot from behind? Why did he send away Sita? In another Samukos discourse, Swami says that every time, you know, what does it take for the avatar to lead a perfect life? After all, he's the director. What does it take for him to make a perfect plot? Why does he make plots with loopholes? He says, only then you will sit and think about the story. Only then you will sit and ask, why did he do this? And only when you ask, why did he do this, you will go deep into the story. And he says, that is why every avatar, including me, Swami said, leave loopholes in the plot so that people can latch on to it and start ruminating over it. And one of the aspects of the story which is most controversial is that of Sita being sent away, right? Before that, the other aspect which is very, very hotly debated is Sugriva being shot from behind. I'm sorry, Vali being shot from behind. In the Ramakatha, very, very beautifully, Swami says the last moments of Vali. You know, Vali is about to die. He's the one who first questions Rama, why did he shoot me from behind? And only Swami can do it because Swami is looking at each character from the point of view of God. It seems once it happened that Swami was very, very upset with somebody in the organization. Some particular deed which he had done which was not right, which Swami did not approve of. So there was this boy, who was a 14-year-old boy, who was sitting in darshan that day, and he saw this scene where Swami came out of the interview room, literally caught hold of the devotee by the collar and threw him out. He said, don't come back here again. Swami was very, very upset with him. So this boy was very surprised to see the scene. So he went to an elder and he asked, he said, sir, this is what happened today and I heard this is what that devotee had done, and Swami was upset with him. My question is, the very first day that devotee did that mistake, Swami would have known it. Why didn't he stop him? Why did he allow him to build on that mistake more and more, and after so many years, punish him like this for one day? And that devotee, with years of experience with Swami, he said this, and I feel it was a very beautiful answer, and there's a lot of truth in it. He said, by nature, Swami cannot see the flaw in a person. By nature, Swami cannot see the flaw in a person. The moment he sees you, he only sees the good part of you. But as an administrator, when mistakes are brought to his notice, he reacts. But as Swami, he cannot see the flaw in any one of us. How true is that? I think each one of us is testimony to that fact, right? If he were to see the fault in us, and I don't know where we all would be, I don't know where I would be, he sees the best part of you. And that is why in the Ramakatha, you have the redemption of so many of these characters. Where even Vali is redeemed. Vali is the one who questions. You know how beautifully Swami says, I'm not sure if it's in the Ramakatha or the other discourses, Swami says that Vali asks Rama, why did you shoot me from behind? And Vali says, Rama, for eons to come, people will point a finger at you. You could have come in front of me, I would have died happily from the arrow that you shot. You know, Swami twists it. He says, Vali feels bad that you will get a bad name. Why did you shoot me from behind? And then Rama is so moved. Rama says, Vali, I will give you back your life. Because, you know, it was not to kill you. It was to punish you. It was to reprimand you. Now that you know that you have done your mistake, now you recognized your mistake, I will give you back your life. Then Vali says, Rama, I've been foolish, I've been stupid, but I'm not so foolish. You know, I'm not so foolish to lose this opportunity of dying at your hand, lying on your lap. Even your father did not have this opportunity. Are you trying to grab this opportunity from me? I have been foolish, but not so foolish. So each one of these characters, when looked at from Swami's point of view, it's completely different. And if you look at it from the point of view that you're looking at the Ramayana like you are looking at a mirror, it is completely different. Let's come to the most controversial, right? Sita being sent away to the forest. For no mistake of hers, she's called. I mean, it's absolutely unacceptable, right? I mean, how can a man just send his innocent wife away, knowing very well that the wife has not done any mistake? It seems in Kodaikanal once this topic came up, and one of the elderly devotees there, very elderly, older than Swami, he started asking this question. Swami, I mean, whatever you say, Swami, it cannot be justified. How can Rama send away Sita like this? So Swami was using the best of his argumentative skills and trying to explain to this devotee that no, Bangaru, it's not like that. It's like this, you know, she did like this, she asked for that, she prayed. But this devotee would not concede any ground. He said, no, Swami, whatever you say, it's wrong. Atlakada Bangaru, if you look at it this way, you know, he said, no, Swami, nothing. How can Rama send away Sita like that? Finally, Swami said, Odlesu Bangaru, aipoyindi, em chesedi ippudu? He said, okay, Bangaru, leave it. It has happened. Nothing can be done now. You know, let bygones be bygones. Swami was saying so helplessly. Nothing, what can be done? It's gone. But you know, in one discourse, I've not come across this in other discourses. In one discourse, Swami explains this, that after the war and Sita is brought back, there is that gathering where Rama is rewarding everyone who has helped him, Sugriva and the Vanaras, Jambavan, everybody. So he looks at Hanuman and he says, Hanuman, what do you want? Of course, one part of it is he is given that necklace. He says that it doesn't have Ramanam, I don't want it. But then Hanuman asks for one thing. He says, Rama, don't give me anything material. I have been with you for all this while. I have noticed the drama as it unfolds, but I'm not able to understand it. You know, what is the essence of this whole play? What is the secret behind it all? What are you trying to convey? You give me this explanation, that's the best reward I can get. No, that's what Hanuman asks for. So Rama looks at Hanuman and he says, I am not qualified to talk about this. No, Rama says, I am not the one who can tell you this. There is only one person who can tell you this, and that is, he says, Sita. He says, Sita will explain it to you. Why? Sita has to explain it. And then Mother Sita explains, she gives this Sukshma Ramayana, as we discussed now, Rama being Atma, Lakshmana being the Manas, Ravana being desire. She shows the Sukshma Ramayana. She says, this is the entire story of the Ramayana. And she says, I am Moola Prakriti. She says, I am Moola Prakriti. I am the Maya Shakti. Because these are all names of Brahma Chaitanya. Because if you read Advaita, if you read Shankara's commentaries, it is Brahma Jnana which gives existence to Atma. If you remove Brahmajnana, Atma does not even have a description. So it is this Maya Shakti, it is this Moola Prakriti which gives form to Atma. And then Mother Sita reveals, I am Moola Prakriti. All you see as Ramayana is my play. It is not Rama's play. She says, I am the one who is playing this entire drama, because Atma is formless, right? Atma is only a witness. And then Mother Sita explains, I am the one who has plotted this entire story. From the time when Rama is born to Dasharatha, probably even before that, till the point the whole of Ramayana is completed, I am the story maker. Rama is only a witness. And now ask yourself, who is being unfair to whom? Was Rama sending away Sita? But going by this Adhyatmik Ramayan, going by the Sukshma Ramayan, what is the essence, what is the need for Sita to go away? As I said, Swami said, there are two types of realization, Jivan Mukti and Videha Mukti. And Swami says, Videha Mukti is attained in a state when you attain the state of Amanaska. And Amanaska is the state where the mind ceases to exist, right? Jivan Mukti or realization is when the mind is filled with the knowledge that the Atma is God. But Amanaska is a state where the mind itself is decimated. So where is the wisdom? So if you go by the Adhyatmik Ramayan, if you go by the Advaitik Ramayan, even if you don't know the story of Ramayana, you will tell that at some point Sita has to go away. Even if you don't know the Ramayana. Because that is how it completes the story. And that is exactly what happens. Rama calls Sita and says that it is time for you to leave. And after a while, she goes back into earth. She goes back into the source. Because, you know, this is the journey. The Jivatma attains that knowledge, and that knowledge eats away the mind itself. And isn't it so clear when Mother Sita says, I am Mula Prakriti, the story is my play, not Rama's. Rama is a mere witness. And when we as intellectual citizens, when we as, you know, people who have a lot of regard for societal makeup, when we say that how can Rama send away Sita, let us not forget that Sita was not an abala. Sita was not a powerless one. Sita was the all-powerful one. And that is why when we worship, you know, you can have temples where Krishna stands alone. You can have temples where Lord Narasimha stands alone. But you should always worship only Sita Rama. Why? Because stand alone, I am also God, you're also God. But I know it, you don't know it. When you don't know it, you're as good as not God. Right? And that is why when worshipping, it is said, you have to worship Sita Rama, because it is only when with Sita Rama is God. But the ultimate state is, even the Sita had to return to her original state. So that this Jivatma reaches that state of Amanaska and transcends the Jivan Mukti which was there at the time of marriage, again at the time of the Pattabhishekam, where the coronation happens, has to eventually lead to this Videha Mukti, the state of Amanaska, where the mind vanishes, the mind with all its knowledge vanishes, and only the Atma alone reigns. And this is the beautiful Ramayana which Swami has given us. And that is why it is a mirror. That is why at every stage of our progress, you can go back and look at it, and you can still see yourself and learn lessons for yourself at that stage in life. And that is why you can read it again and again and again. And that is why Swami spoke of it again and again. And that is why any number of authors will come and rephrase it and put it in their own description. And still it would be worth going into. And it is that Ramayana we all had the opportunity to think about for the past 60 minutes. I thank Swami for the opportunity to go into all these discourses. I mean, I just would like to tell that none of this was my interpretation. None of this was my interpretation, because each one of this is actually told in Swami's discourses. It's just that so many plenty of discourses and it's lost in that ocean. But all of this is in Swami's discourses, and this is the true Ramayana which Swami wants us to see. Because without this, I mean, it's like we are watching a Chinese movie without subtitles, right? I mean, you can get an idea of it, but you're not getting the movie completely. So thanking Swami for giving us all these beautiful words, and thanking all of you for your very, very patient listening, I offer this humble talk at Swami's lotus feet. Let's conclude with Samasta Loka Sukhino Bhavantu. Om Samasta Lokaha
Sukhino bhavantu samasta lokah. Sukhino bhavantu samasta lokah. Sukhino bhavantu. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Jai Bolo Bhagwan Shri Satya Sai Baba Ji Ki. Yeah.